Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Love. Love is a fundamental concern for all of us. Most people would list love as the most important element in a happy life. Yet our knowledge of how love evolves, how we can have love, and how it helps us attain happiness is surprisingly scant. Love plays a crucial role in every aspect of human existence, including sex, spirituality, society, and even the meaning of life. But what about the different kinds of love? For our children, for our neighbors, for our friends? Is love a matter of luck, or is it an art that can be mastered? Our guest today is Dr. Armin Zadeh, author of the new book, The Forgotten Art of Love, What Love Means and Why It Matters. He is a cardiologist and professor at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Zadeh has authored more than 100 scientific articles and is an editor of scholarly books in medicine. He lives with his family in New Jersey. Hello, Armin, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hello, Paul. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, in your book, which was a great read, by the way, and thank you for writing it, The Forgotten Art of Love, you are revisiting Erich Fromm's work, that seminal work back in the late 60s called The Art of Loving, which you describe as a book that has fascinated you for decades. What was it about Fromm's work that captured you?
Well, I have to say I read it about 30 years ago. And so I was in my early 20s. And it had happened so that my parents had it in their shelves, and my mom is a psychologist and my dad a forensic psychiatrist, so we had lots of these kind of books at home, and it caught my eye, and I was fascinated by it because I felt that Fromm's vision and concept of love was very different from what I had encountered or experienced thus far. So he was radical in his claim that love, as is often portrayed in our society, as this serendipitous phenomenon which may happen to us or not, and gives us these overwhelming feelings, and is really not what we think it is. And so he clearly separated the intense feelings, particularly in the beginning when you fall in love, with what he called actual love. So he really had a quite radical diversion from what our traditional concept of love was. And I found it fascinating. And I found at that time that he got a lot of things right. It really rang true to me. At the same time, I felt, well, maybe not quite. He pushed the balance very far to a very cerebral, intellectual concept of love, and really did not talk much about emotion. So I felt there's a lot of things there, but there's also some things missing. And he also wrote it, or it was published in 1956, with a background coming, you know, from psychology and in religion also to a large extent. And obviously a lot of things have happened since. And I felt that maybe to do justice, to look at love more comprehensively, you know, we need to look at beyond psychology and religion and looking from other angles as well. But I felt at that time, 30 years ago, I was not in a position to really comprehensively address that. So I always wanted to write a response to Erich Fromm, but I parked that idea in the back of my mind and just went on with my education and life, but it was still always with me, and I kept reading and educating myself on the topic until I felt in a position just to to write these thoughts down.
Uh-huh. And so the thing that you appreciated about Fromm's approach was characterizing love as an art.
Yes.
As opposed to some lucky event.
That's right. And my title of the book, as you noted, The Forgotten Art of Love, you know, strongly, you know, hints at Fromm's book, essentially
right.
Expressing my agreement, you know, with the concept of love as an art.
Mm-hmm. And so in what ways do you think Fromm didn't get it right or left out critical factors?
Well, let me first start off with saying what he got right and why I think he agreed with his description of love as an art. And so he described a distinction between the initial phase when we fall in love at the beginning of the relationship with the long-term phase of love. And the skill part, or rather the art part, he describes as to maintain love in the long run, you need to have certain skills to do that, and knowledge and maturity, but particularly certain sets, set of skills. To maintain love in the long run, and that I found a very powerful and true concept. And on the other hand, he spoke about love, and again, very much as intellectual concept, ignored the acknowledged maybe the powerful emotions, you know, we come with love. So basically what I felt is that they need to be, these two concepts need to be combined. It needs to be acknowledged that there is a strong intellectual concept, a mind component of love, and that it goes along with the emotion. I think that was the piece which I felt was particularly missing. But at the same time, I felt that in particularly in these days, the commitment portion of love is not adequately considered in these days, and that's, you know, why it requires remembrance. So bringing these two things together, I think. Really increases our chances of success.
And how would you define success? What is the definite? I mean, what is the difference between actual love and just falling in love?
So success, I would describe as maintaining a focus on love. So the fundamental problem. Fromm pointed out, which I agree with him, is that in general, we have, in the beginning, we fall in love, we have these very overwhelming, almost obsessive feelings for somebody. And then over a period of time, 3 to 4 years, they eventually subside. And if these very powerful, very strong feelings starting to subside, there is the tendency of people to believe that their love has, in fact, ended or is not as strong anymore. So, but the evidence now, and Fromm hypothesized that at that time, but there's evidence actually from science now supporting his view, is that this is a very distinct phase in human relationships, this falling in love phase associated with very powerful release of hormones, very specific brain activity, which very predictably then ceases after, again, 3 to 4 years. So if we assume that this is love, then, you know, and we will be inevitably disappointed because this phase does not last eternally. And that's, I think, very important to point out. And in fact, there is a peak in relationship breakup after 3 to 4 years because folks are disappointed that the feelings are not as overwhelming as they used to be. Now, then the actual long-term love may start after the falling in love period. And that is the period where it requires much more of our own involvement, because the falling in love phase is very easy because we are under the influence of all these powerful hormones. So it's very easy for us to focus on our partner, on our relationship, because that's what it's all about. Our brain makes us do that. But after 3 to 4 years, then these hormones, they slowly subside, and then we are, our mind is exposed again to all the many distractions we encounter in daily life. And that's where the skill comes in, that we are have to maintain our focus on love. And that's I find the success. If we maintain our focus on love, it will benefit our relationships, but it will also benefit our well-being in general. But that is difficult, and it's difficult because, again, we are so easily distracted by many, many things at any minute, any second of the day. And the skill and the art of love is just to maintain that focus and kind of fade out or face out all these distractions in the back of our minds.
Now that, you know, to somebody who is romantically inclined, that sounds a lot like work. And it sort of reminds me of back in the 80s, there was a, or maybe it was the 90s, there was this relationship book that came out about, it was entitled Making Love Work. And then I read it and I thought, God, they should change the title of Making Love Into Work, because it sounded like a lot of work. But it does, to maintain a focus on anything, is kind of, it requires a dedicated commitment, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I agree with you. I try to avoid that term work, because it does sound not very romantic. And I like that word commitment better, or focus. I like the word focus a lot. But at the end of the day, that is the key ingredient for a successful relationship, is to sort out in our mind, you know, what at a given time is more important than others. And it shows among long-term relationships which are very successful and they're very happy. That's what couples do. They are prioritizing the happiness of the other one over other matters, in particular over other self-serving matters. And if both partners do that, then this is these are key ingredients for happy long-term relationships.
Now, you know, until 1800 or even later, we didn't have any freedom to choose much of anything. I mean, we knew where we were going to live, we knew what we were going to do, and we knew who we were going to marry by the time we were 12 years old. So this whole freedom to love anybody you want and this whole romantic thing is a fairly new thing. Dating was invented in the 19th century. And what do you have to say about the impact of the romantic paradigm, this idea that the only way to form an intimate partnership is to fall in love with somebody who falls in love with you at the same time?
Well, I would say that that concept that the success of this concept is not supported by data. If you look at societies and cultures around the world, and there are many, many places where they are still arranged marriages, etc. And there's no really conclusive evidence that people who choose their partners and follow the paradigm of Western models of romantic love, that they are happier.
Right.
So it is not necessarily supported by evidence that this leads to greater happiness. And in a way, it actually may cause more problems because obviously if you have the options and then you put in a lot of different constraints on your partner selection, which we often see in this day and age, which makes it more difficult to find partners. And these criteria are obviously strongly influenced by society, but also by personal upbringing, et cetera, et cetera. So we see it all the time that people are looking for partners, but they say, well, I just don't want to have a partner. I want to have a partner who is like this, 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 and this, and this, and this.
Right.
Which, again, I think kind of distracts from the essence of finding somebody to share time or even a life with, because the more criteria, and we have to admit that these criteria are essentially arbitrary. They're not absolute criteria, because we know that, because a different person looks at the same person and finds very different things fascinating, appealing in a person. So these are essentially rather arbitrary criteria which we place on us or restrict our partner selection with, which actually is in some way a impediment to
right. Our partner. Well, I'm not sure. Can you give me an example of the arbitrary kinds of criteria that you're referring to?
Well, the most commonly, if people are looking for other partners based on physical attraction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, also there is people be attracted by status, by power, by certain way people dress, and the image they portray, all these things have an influence,
and
the question is again, these are criteria which may be very different in other countries and other cultures, where people may just place a greater emphasis on wisdom or kindness, etc. And we know also from history that these criteria have changed in our society. What is called, what's considered to be attractive among couples, has changed quite a bit over time.
And what kind of criteria would you recommend? Everybody has criteria. Everybody has some idea of what they are, what they want, or what they're looking for. And maybe it would be better if we didn't see pictures of people before we met them. But then I remember I used to go on a lot of blind dates when I was a young man, and that wasn't a very successful way to do it either. I was depending on somebody else's criteria. But what criteria, how do you judge whether criteria makes sense or not? I agree with you that we have a lot of superficial criteria. People are swiping left or right based on somebody's picture.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty shallow. But what is the right way to find a mate?
Well, I don't think there is a right or wrong, and I would be the last person to tell somebody, well, you shouldn't do that, or shouldn't have this criterion or this criterion, because at the end of the day, it depends on the individual and what the individual wants. What I would say is, and obviously, people looking for partners for different reasons, and as such, the criteria there may be different. But I would say, in general, if we are out to find a partner for life, let's say, and say, all right, I want to find somebody to share my life with, then I would say, you want to look for a track record of somebody having a meaningful relationships, not necessarily romantic relationships, but meaningful and lasting relationships with other people, having evidence of consideration for others, and certain characteristics which convey care for others. This to me would be signs that somebody would be looking for a relationship, which is supposed to last.
Right.
Now, in terms of external characteristics, that's The key thing here is that we know that a lot of relationships occur for people when they are working or they spend a lot of time together, for instance, at the workplace, etc. Because what happens there is that people, once they spend more time together, they actually appreciate the ways of a person and a certain kindness, niceness, etc., which makes them more attractive, as opposed to if you have just a picture, then you don't really know anything about this person, and you just immediately place a judgment or in your mind, conscious or not conscious, about this person, and may reject that person just based on that ground. But if you if you try not to have your mind guided by these external characteristics, then you are in a position to give this person really a chance. And I think that's what it is most about, just to give people to really look, what kind of person somebody is, and not just to judge prematurely.
Now, you say in the book that a key element of the art of loving is prioritizing the happiness of somebody over other impulses you may have. In other words, being focused on love, because love is supporting the happiness of the other, right?
Right. Yeah, that is essentially the key principle. The key principle of love is to work towards the happiness and well-being of somebody else. The problem again is that seems to be, or it sounds pretty easy, but at most of the time we are driven by other motivations, by other drives. And at any given time, we want to do, for instance, career obviously is always something which is a strong motivator for us. And then there are a lot of self-directed drives which act upon us in all given time. And again, the key problem is that they're distracting us from focusing on the happiness and well-being of somebody else. And I guess the underlying point which I'm trying to get is in the book is why that is. Why is it that certain drives lead to a certain effect in our brain versus others? And I feel that there is actually a lot of biology there, in that we are, at the end of the day, we are driven by a lot of different motivations, but by our evolutionary progress in our biology, it seems like we are particularly made to look out for others, and that in fact that is a big portion of the reason why the human race has been so successful over millions and millions of years. And I found it very interesting that Darwin, in his books about human evolution, actually very strongly argues that point, that love and the care for others is an essential part of the success of human race. Whereas in general, most of the time, his paradigm of the survival of the fittest is being cited, but that applies more to animal evolution as to human evolution.
Right. It is interesting, and I really love that your book points that out, because Darwin had a lot more to say about humans than we ever hear. Now, you say in the book that love for a partner, and with it sexual desire, can be restored by conscious effort. Loving attention to a partner promotes an increase in sexual desire in the partner. Can you speak to this?
Sure. Yeah. So it comes down to the kind of same principle we talked about before, that our mind or brain is distracted by impulses, and And some of these impulses, obviously, you know, over time, change. If you have a partner for many years, there's evidence to suggest that sexual attraction towards the same partner somewhat declines. And by no means to say it disappears, but it's a natural phenomenon that there's some decline, and at the same time, there is ongoing attraction to other partners, and that's it's a natural phenomenon, and which is obviously well founded in the evolutionary principles. So this is something which, you know, to most of us is a reality, and our brain again, you know, gives us these impulses and say, well, you know, look for other partners, etc. But we have control over that, you know, so we can be mindful of our our brain's impulses and reject those, and instead focusing on our partner actively, and looking at all the wonderful things our partner you know, has, and by that actually increasing, you know, the attractiveness of our partner. And it goes back again to the same principle as before. You know, some people who don't know each other at all, they see pictures and they may not be particularly attracted to somebody, but the same people, they spend a lot of time together, they see all of a sudden very other things which they had not noticed before or just even recognized on a simple picture. So, but we have to allow ourselves to see that beauty in another person, and that is sometimes difficult because, again, we are distracted by maybe what we perceive as flaws. You know, it's easy for our brain to say, all right, there's a flaw, there's something which is not perfect. But I think the powerful ability of a brain is such that we can reject that and say, I don't want to look at that flaw. I want to focus on all the beautiful aspects of that person. And it is actually something which works really well.
Well, that's beautiful. And I'm so grateful that you wrote a book that's helping people learn how to do this. And there's so much more we could explore today, but we've run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.lovetheforgottenart.org, O-R-G. That's Love the Forgotten Art, all one word. And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview anytime you like, via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we have been visiting with Dr. Armin Zadeh, author of The Forgotten Art of Love, What Love Means and Why It Matters. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into the Pathways program, which is broadcast and streamed worldwide via KBOO.FM on Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled DIVINATION.com, as well as via iTunes and other podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Dr. Armin Zadeh and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.